Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you've read my work on medievalist.net, or if you've read my book, conveniently called The 5-Minute Medievalist, you probably already know that while I love kings and queens and princes and princesses, I'm much more interested in what life was like for ordinary people during the Middle Ages. That's why, for today's episode, I've invited Dr. David Green of Harlaxton College to speak with me about his book, The Hundred Years' War, A People's History. The book covers the war's impact on everyone from clergy to soldiers to women, and so does our conversation. Here's David Green on some ordinary people's experience of the Hundred Years' War. Thanks, David, for joining us on the podcast today. It's great to have you here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So we're here to talk about the Hundred Years' War, and I think that what we need to address first is probably, what was this war about? So what started it?
Yeah, it's not an entirely straightforward question, of course. There are a series of both long-term and short-term causes, and the war itself gives a certain momentum to the struggle. So what they're fighting about at the end of the war may not be the same sort of things as were under dispute when it kicks off. I suppose the most obvious thing to talk about, though, initially is the question of sovereignty. And this really is one of those long-term causes. Because of issues going back, frankly, to the Norman Conquest, and certainly since the Angevin Empire, kings of England owned or controlled large areas of France. Most important of these in the context of the Hundred Years' War was Gascony, but of course you could go back and include Normandy as part of that. And this means that over a period of time, kings of England are exercising very considerable authority within France, and that irritates and causes a number of problems for the French monarchy. And as the 13th century goes on, and as the French monarchy is growing in power, it also means that kings of England are feeling increasingly limited in what they can do themselves. So English kingship in the late 13th century is sort of redefining itself. It's seeing itself as increasingly imperial in character. There is this idea that the king should be as an emperor in his kingdom. And that's very difficult if you are the feudal inferior, you are the feudal vassal of another monarch. So how does the King of England operate as King of England when he is also Duke of Gascony? How does that restrict his ability to act? Can he make any sort of alliances with the King of France's enemies? How does that affect his relationship, for example, with Scotland? If Scotland has an alliance with France, what does that mean that the King of England can do in terms of his own relationship with Scotland? That, of course, becomes of increasing significance. So you've got a situation in which there is something that could be seen over a long period of time as a fundamentally untenable relationship between the kings of England and France because of this peculiar situation in which a sovereign king of England is also the feudal vassal of a French monarch. There are periods of increasing tension that develop. It's often seen that the Treaty of Paris in 1259 is an important stage in the development in the lead up to the war. This is a point where Henry III of England actually acknowledges the feudal superiority of the French king, at that point Louis IX. And then there are a series of other periods, coronations and other outbreaks of hostilities between England and France, in which the tension between England and France ratcheted up over the next 80 odd years. And there are outbreaks of war at various points. They don't go on for very long, but it is clear that this relationship is going to be very difficult to maintain in the long term. That becomes even more problematic when the English gain a claim not only to certain lands in France, but to the French throne. In 1328, the last Capetian king dies, and Edward III, only recently come to the throne of England, Edward III is the closest male heir. But his claim comes through the female line, and that is used as an excuse or a reason by the French nobility not to accept that. And so instead it passes to a cadet branch of the Capetians, and Philip VI Valois king comes to the throne instead. So we've got that question of sovereignty over various lands in France. We've now got an issue also of the French crown itself. Frankly, for the most part, the French crown is probably not considered to be the most significant issue by the English for the duration of the war. There are perhaps particular periods in which it seems like a real, it might be an objective which really could be realised. But for the most part, it seems to be a diplomatic sort of tool, a bargaining chip, which can be used in order to get the French to accept that the English have full sovereignty in their lands in France. So there's that question of sovereignty. I suppose another issue is it's really difficult to find a sort of neutral arbiter who could bring about any sort of resolution to this. After 1309, the papacy is relocated to Avignon, which is theoretically neutral territory, but certainly pretty much everyone in England believes to be a part of France. The papacy is seen as a French puppet, and so there's not really anyone who can bring this situation to some sort of resolution. The papacy tries, but it fails. I think there are also economic dimensions. Gascony is valuable for the wine trade. There are also issues to do with the wool trade in Flanders. And so the wine and the wool trade also sort of compound the situation. The English have great interests in both, and the French want to gain control of those valuable markets and resources. But that's a further issue which is significant. And then over the course of the war, there are various other places that become significant. Scotland's important. There are various succession disputes that take place in Brittany and in Castile that become important as well. And they sort of fan the flames of the ongoing struggle. But the thing which sort of lights the blue touch paper in 1337, when the war is traditionally said to begin, is the defection of French nobleman, Robert of Artois. He's wanted by the French crown for various crimes he's been accused of, including murder, and he goes and seeks sanctuary in England, and Edward III refuses to hand him over, and this is seen as an abrogation of his feudal responsibilities, and so Philip VI formally confiscates Gascony. And what we've chosen, rightly or wrongly, to call the Hundred Years' War kicks off then and sort of resolves itself in 1453.
Well, I like that you're getting at the very, very complicated nature of this whole war, because I think when people look back at the Middle Ages, and especially look at the common people, they think of it as kind of a homogenous group. So, you know, the king says it's time to go to war, and everyone agrees and everyone goes to war. But your book is a people's history, and you really get at how not everyone was on board with this, especially the peasantry. We imagine that, you know, the king says it's time to go to war and the peasants are all on board, but that wasn't really the case, was it?
No. Well, yes and no. I think it depends if you're talking about the French peasantry or the English peasantry. It depends if you're talking about peasants who are living on the south coast of England or those who are living on the Scottish border. It depends if you're dealing with French peasants who have been living in relative peace under English control in Gascony or those that are living elsewhere. So you're absolutely right that there is not a sense of homogenization. Perhaps what the Hundred Years' War creates is a greater sense of national identity is really a problematic concept. But I think because of the way that the war unfolds, there is a sense in which the peripheries of both kingdoms are connected more closely to the centre by the end of the struggle than they have been. Obviously, that's the case in France because English interference and English involvement, with the exception of Calais, is removed. So France is French to a greater extent at the end of the war than it had been at the beginning. And perhaps England is more English too, although there are huge political divisions that remain. I mean, with regard to the peasantry, it is, of course, terribly difficult often to know what large bodies of the population really think about. But it's also clearly the case that many groups of peasants throughout the struggle are actively taking a stance against not necessarily the king, but certainly against sections of the nobility and sections of the church. There are major peasant revolts that take place in both England and France. It's difficult to say whether this is always sort of against the war. Sometimes it's against the way the war has been fought, and it's a complaint about the failure of the elite to do what they're supposed to do, either in pursuing the war effectively or protecting the peasantry. So it's really difficult to say whether the war is popular, I think, on either side. I mean, in, to some extent, of course, it's popular in the sense that we can clearly see that sections of the peasantry getting extremely angry when the war or the taxes that they're paying, for example, are not seen as being spent appropriately. But equally, there are large periods in which the peasantry would clearly want the war just to end, that under whatever circumstances it is, whether they are currently under a period of occupation by the English or whoever, and you know, anything for a quiet life. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because I think there is a sense in which the peasants on both sides become to some extent sort of most investors in a national project. They're forced, but at the same time, knowing precisely what the attitudes of the majority of the peasantry is really difficult.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not a very helpful answer.
No, but not everyone was on board with this all the time. Another thing that you get at in the book is one of the tools that kings used to get people on their side was the clergy. And they were using the clergy as a way of spreading their message. So how would they do that?
Yeah, there's no doubt that both sides use the clergy in slightly different ways, perhaps, in order to try and put forward justice, the legitimacy of what they're trying to do. So kings of England undoubtedly use parochial clergy. Parish priests are issued with sort of official sermons in which what's going on in the war and what the king aims to achieve can be distributed as a message to the population at large. The church, of course, is perhaps the most effective way of getting that message over. Sermons are preached in the vernacular, so you know that sort of thing is very easy. There are also prayers which are requested for the success of royal expeditions. There are religious processions that take place. The development of national saints is another way by which a sort of religious message can be linked to the legitimacy of what's going on.
So an English person would go to church, perhaps, and hear a sermon that's all about Edward's legitimacy, and then say prayers for the war effort, and then, yeah, you know, venerate a saint that was related. That's what you're saying, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, and similar sorts of things, although the clergy seems to be used in a slightly different sort of way in France. Perhaps to a greater extent, the French clergy are being used as slightly more elite level to develop sort of theories of kingship, theories of French royal legitimacy, the rather more sophisticated diplomatic side of fighting the war. It's not so that the English aren't doing this as well, but the French seem to be doing it in a slightly more sophisticated way, and certainly in terms of writing sort of official histories of the war. There is no doubt that the French clergy, particularly those most famously at the Abbey of Saint-Denis, are really closely involved in constructing an official account of the struggle in which the legitimacy of Valois aims is being pushed throughout. There are, of course, English chronicles, but there isn't quite the same sort of official history. Now, those sorts of things, of course, are aimed at much more of a at an elite audience. But chronicles often contain campaign letters and that sort of thing, which come back from the front. And those sorts of campaign letters sometimes are also part of sermon addresses and might be delivered to the population as well. So there's all sorts of ways in which the clergy are involved. I do think as well the sort of development of a national saint, both St Michael in France and St George in England, is an important way by which people are drawn together, and they're both sort of very militaristic figures.
That's right. It's helpful to have a militaristic saint on your side. And the church was involved in really practical terms as well. You mentioned that in England, the clergy was actually kitted out to defend their regions as well. And in France, people were building up the churches as defensive outposts as well. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in England, this is more the case on the south coast. It's one of the, you know, relatively few times when churchmen are officially tasked with these sorts of defensive responsibilities. In France, it's a much more regular basis. It's not always, frankly, that churchmen themselves are always terribly keen on this, but for very obvious reasons, churches are often the most sort of defensible structures in a town or a small village which might come under an English or a mercenary raid. And so many of those are fortified. And there are deep concerns about from church authorities about whether this is going to have an effect on their religious role. You know, how can you maintain proper religious observance if you've sort of fundamentally changed the character of the building where that's taking place? So there are questions about that. And sometimes, frankly, the French secular authorities are rather worried about individual communities essentially building their own castles and what's going to happen to these places subsequently. There's also, though, absolutely no doubt that French churches and monasteries are subjected to absolutely awful and fairly consistent raiding in certain parts, and so probably have to take steps. And if they don't, there's also a good deal of evidence for various parishes and sort of religious communities just being completely devastated, and areas for sort of 30 years after just being sort of denuded. They talk about, you know, not even a cockerel crew in these places. So, you know, there is a real effect on religious life. So the church is both central to the war. It is deeply affected by the war. It probably changes fairly fundamentally as a result of the war as well, because kings and queens in both England and France are seeking to use churches for their own purposes. And it's probably the case that you start to see increasingly sort of national churches emerging. You know, people are forced to make a decision over whether their allegiance should be, for example, primarily to the Pope or to the King. And so I'm not for a moment suggesting that this is sort of seeds of Reformation or anything like that, but you can start to see a few shifts in the way in which religious allegiances are.
And when you talked a second ago about defending churches and churches being a good place for defense, you mentioned mercenaries. So I think this is a good opportunity to talk about how the Hundred Years' War really changed the military, in that at the beginning, it was mostly feudal people that were brought up as part of their agreement. And by the end, you have standing armies, which is a real shift. So maybe you could talk for a minute about how the structure of the army changed over this time.
Yeah, again, it's different between what's happening in England and what happens in France. I suppose you could say that the English become, if you like, semi-professional very early on in the Hundred Years' War. For the French, it's a more protracted process, although by the end, they have probably become sort of fully professional. There are various developments that happen in France in the 1440s. Which establish really a proper professional standing army. You don't quite get that in England. In England, the opening of the war is still, you can still see the majority of armies being recruited, as you say, using traditional feudal means. I'm not sure if we're allowed to say feudal anymore.
No, anyway. We did anyway.
We're saying it anyway. Fairly soon, though, certainly by the 1350s, armies are being recruited using a system of indentures. So individual captains are indented, have contracts with the monarchy to recruit so many soldiers who are armed in a particular sort of way, you know, with particular sort of weaponry, and who will serve for a specified period of time. And we're told where they have to collect together to embark for France and so on. This establishes a pattern of, as I say, sort of semi-professionalism at a very early stage. It allows for a fairly flexible system, so you can bring in different sorts of troops for different sorts of campaigns. It might help if you're sort of equipping a garrison, or if you're going on one of the chevauchées, one of these huge raiding expeditions which characterise English tactics in the first half of the war. It does mean, of course, as well, that we start to see the use of many greater numbers of longbowmen in English armies. And you start to see, to some extent, a decline in the importance of the aristocracy as a sort of backbone of English expeditionary forces. This is not to say for a moment that the aristocracy are no longer interested in military things, but they're just not playing exactly the same sort of role. The English are attempting to use a military system, a strategic model, which relies primarily on infantry and archers rather than on heavy cavalry. And so that requires different sorts of troops, and they can be recruited using these semi-professional indenture methods. The French experiment with different sorts of recruiting methods, partly as a result of defeats, particularly at Crecy in 1346 and at Poitiers in 1356. And in the late 1350s and early 1360s, you do see some major changes in the way that the French are going about recruiting. And they are extremely effective, frankly, in the 1370s and 1380s. You don't see too many set-piece battles, but there's no doubt that the French military machine has taken a number of steps forward. But mainly because of internal French political problems, those military developments aren't maintained. And it's not really until Charles VII's reign, and when we get to the 1440s and the development of these sort of formal companies, that you see the development of a professional French army. What's developed also by then, and what these professional forces are including, of course, is a different sort of weapon, gunpowder. And that, again, has sort of changed the nature of warfare to some extent. Whether we call this a revolution, again, is something which is open to debate. But I don't think there's any question that you see a major evolution in this period. And different sorts of troops using different sorts of tactics, and to a certain extent, different sorts of weapons, have changed the sort of colour of warfare.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think when people look back to the Hundred Years' War, they definitely think of archers. And some of the statistics that you mentioned were pretty impressive, where some of the English attacks had archers, like a ratio of archers to other troops as being 3, 4, 5 to 1, and with Agincourt, 20 to 1, which is pretty amazing. But people don't tend to think of guns and cannons being part of warfare in the Middle Ages, but it was a huge part of the Hundred Years' War, even if it wasn't particularly effective. I mean, you mentioned in your book about the Duke of Burgundy firing 412 cannonballs into a city and killing only a chicken.
I like that. I'm sorry for the chicken. I mean, it's clearly possible to easy to exaggerate the role there. But they're used early. There's evidence of cannon being used at Crecy in 1346. Clearly, they're having a greater role in siege warfare than on the sort of open battlefield. But equally, the last battle of the Hundred Years' War, the last major battle of Castillon in 1453, is sort of accidentally decided through the use of gunpowder weapons. No, it's a siege, and the guns get turned round on the advancing or the relieving English forces. And it is becoming increasingly effective. They're not completely replacing other sorts of missile weapons. But again, you can see this as part of a longer term trend. And undoubtedly, monarchs can see the value of this, and they are investing in it to a very considerable extent.
The archers that are being used in the Hundred Years' War, obviously hugely effective, made a big difference in many of the battles, but it takes a lot of effort to make an archer. You know, you have to start them really, really early to give them the strength to do that. And you're mentioning, speaking of archers, that it's not coincidental that this is when Robin Hood legends start to come up. Not only is Robin an archer, but he's also not a nobleman. So it's an interesting time, I think, for the peasantry, or at least the non-nobility, to be thinking of themselves in different terms.
Yeah, I mean, there's the rise of the yeoman as a sort of top rank of the peasantry, but a non-noble figure, is really significant. This, of course, isn't just a product of the Hundred Years' War. The other great sort of social factor in this period, of course, is the Black Death and the impact of plague and the way that that shifts social and economic and political balances in a whole variety of areas. It's really difficult to, you know, disentangle what war impacts and what plague impacts. But I don't think there's any doubt that this is a period of very considerable social fluidity. And the emergence of Robin, I mean, I remember reading somewhere, and I can't remember who said this, that Robin is the only non-noble hero of a major literary cycle for about 200 years. And the fact that he emerges in this period, I mean, first mentioned, I think, in Piers Plowman, and you get the first major poetic cycles being, you know, written in the early 15th century. It does say something about the period. But he's also, you know, a divisive figure, isn't he? He's not only non-noble, but he actively breaks away from service. He is an outlaw. He is, you know, all these sorts of things. So it's not necessarily that these are a yeoman who are desperately happy with the idea of national service and we're all going to sort of go in together. You know, it's saying that this is a period of change and uncertainty and upset and of a whole variety of ways.
Yeah. And what you're mentioning about the Black Death and the war, it actually made a lot of changes for women as well, because there were less men around than there had been before. So I'd like to get into the role of women a little bit more. You don't draw definitive parallels between, you know, the Hundred Years' War and the 20th century wars, but there are some parallels, though, I think, where women are taking over men's roles, especially in manufacture. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about what women were doing.
Yeah, I think that there, again, quite how one disentangles the impact of war and plague and other sort of social and economic factors is really tough. But there is no doubt that women are allowed to and perhaps required to take on an increasing range of roles in the post-plague period. And perhaps the Hundred Years' War exaggerates some of those trends. So you see women being involved in a range of trades and getting access to guilds and that sort of thing that they hadn't previously. So you can find women, for example, working in places like armoury, you know, which, you know, previously would have been difficult, certainly, for them to gain access. There perhaps is a greater degree of personal freedom as well, you know, opportunities to choose one's marriage partner, perhaps to marry rather later in life than had been the case earlier. There's been a long debate about whether the period of a sort of 100 years after the outbreak of the Black Death was a golden age for women. I mean, in some ways, there's no doubt that certain women gain a greater degree of personal freedom. But at the same time, if women are, you know, seeing the death of between 30 and 50% of their friends and loved ones and everything else, it's probably not a beautiful time to be around. And particularly if they're in France and they're subject to all the appalling circumstances of English and mercenary attack and sometimes depredation by their own side. You know, it's hard to see that in those terms. Again, we have rather more evidence, of course, for what's happening to noble women than peasant women. But there's no doubt that women become politically and socially more prominent in this period. It's not something which is sustained in the long term. The conclusion of the war slowed regrowth of the population. And certainly changing religious attitudes when you get into the 16th century really do seem to restrict things. Nor do I want to say for a moment that this is a period in which women are being accepted as anywhere near equal and the obvious example, of course, is Joan of Arc. And but, you know, there's no question that, you know, her treatment is based on just very solid misogyny, which has been developing for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, it's, she's definitely an exception. And and the way she's treated is very much consistent with the times, I think. But you do have some people like Christine de Pizan who are writing about how women should be stepping up and taking a role, and how women were stepping up and taking a role. If their husbands were gone, they had to defend themselves, and they had to know a little bit about how to do that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Again, I mean, I think we're talking about advice which is aimed certainly at a literate audience, and again, as a result of that, probably an aristocratic one. But there's no doubt that, I suppose, what Christine is sort of hinting at, and where this sort of thing can work within that very prejudicial context, is the domestic sphere. So women can protect their home, and that home can be defined in a fairly broad sense. But the fact that someone like Christine can write all sorts of things, and not just guides for women, but mirrors for princes, and very, you know, clearly very extensively read military guides, general political commentaries, all sorts of works, and that her works are read by and aimed at and dedicated to a host of, you know, really significant political figures, and that she is clearly a really significant part of the French court, you know, does indicate that there are opportunities, not necessarily for all women, but certainly for exceptional women. Of course, there are also, there's the role of queens, and certain queens at certain times play absolutely vital roles in the conduct of the war, either when their husbands are absent for a variety of reasons, either when they're on campaign, or whether they're imprisoned, or whether in the case of Charles VI and Henry VI, they are, as they are described, as absent mentally. So under those circumstances, there are, again, very significant and exceptional women that do play very important roles. Yeah, I certainly don't see you can see that this is a great time for women. Certainly not. It's not a great time for the peasantry at all. But those groups which suffer through the war also, perhaps only in a short-term sense, benefit to some extent from the war.
Yeah. And I mean, we've just scratched the surface, but you really go through that in the book, going through the roles of peasants and nobility and clergy and women, and really kind of get at how their lives change, sometimes for the better and sometimes for worse.
Sure.
It was definitely a tumultuous time. And I want to thank you for joining us, because I thought it was a great book and I learned a lot of things, and I hope the people who are listening have as well. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. No, pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you. To find out more about what David's up to, you can follow him on Twitter at David1356. That's David1356. His book is The Hundred Years' War, A People's History, from Yale University Press. Before we go, we have Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. So what's on the website this week, and are you feeling any better?
Hi, Danielle. Yeah, I'm feeling a little better. Still get a bit of the cough. I think it's a Canadian thing. You once you get a flu, you're have it for the rest of the season. So, but I'm doing well. So, and yeah, the website's back on track with new content, and I'm pretty happy with that.
Awesome. What's up?
Yeah, we welcomed a new monthly columnist to the website, Gillian Polak. She's an Australian scholar and writer, and she's looking at novels that are set in the medieval past and how fiction gives us a platform to see the Middle Ages. So her first piece is on a book called Vikings Dawn, which was written by Henry Treece, a very popular young adult writer in the 1940s to 1960s. So this is one of his most famous books. So she takes a look at that, and I'm really excited about this series. You know, she's going to be taking like a different novels, different authors. So I think it'd be something a little different for the website. I'm really happy to have it. A couple other things that I'll just make note of is we have a piece on Vikings and fish, dried fish. So that's an article though, if you're interested in all for any kind of foodies out there. And we also have an article that makes a case that Njalsaga is the best Icelandic saga. So if there's one to choose from, it's Njalsaga, and you'll find out why. So that's on the website this week. So please check it out.
Thanks, Peter. We'll talk to you next week. If you've been enjoying the podcast so far, please take a second before you go and rate us on whichever platform you're on. As I've said before, we're a small operation and so grateful for you lending us your ears each week. Your reviews will help us bring more medieval goodness to more people, which is, of course, my reason for being, as well as medievalist.net's. As always, you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And you can follow me, Danielle Sabalski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. You can grab a copy of my books, The 5 Minute Medievalist and The 5 Minute Medievalist's Guide to Surviving the Zombie Apocalypse on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks so much for listening and for taking a second to give us a review. Have yourself a great day.